From Awareness to Action, Creating Bridges Across Differences with Roxy Manning. This is session one.
I am just really deeply moved at the commitment of NVC Academy to keep bringing work on these topics of equity, inclusion, social change to our network because it's so sorely needed. I am really delighted because one of the things that really nurtures me is a sense that this work matters, it's being held, and that people are wanting to continue to learn and to share and spread it throughout our network and the world. So thank y'all for taking a risk on this course. I'm always a little bit nervous thinking about teaching. I like to start off with a little bit of vulnerability about that. There's always this idea that, you know, you're the expert and you're the main teacher, and so I'm giving you knowledge. And that's generally not how I like to move through the world. What I'm hoping to do in this course and throughout the 6 weeks is to share some thoughts that other folks generally have come up with that I found helpful and invite y'all to engage with them and to think about them and to think, how can I use this in my life? How can I have to support the work that I want to do in the world? So a lot of the learning is going to happen from each other, from the things that you share, the things that you bring to the class, the life experiences that you're going to bring. And I'm seeing myself as a grand facilitator, not, you know, this massive expert of anything. So we'll see how things unfold. What I'd like to do is to start a little bit to share a bit of the framing of the course. The way that I'm conceptualizing it, and this is a new course that's kind of combining different bodies of knowledge for me. The way that I'm conceptualizing it is that I want to take us to think about, how do we change what's happening? How do we actually get ourselves excited and moving towards creating change? And normally when I've thought about that, I kind of think, okay, what's wrong with the other person? I'm not sure how many of y'all have been in that place already, right? You see things that are going on in the world and you think, they're doing something wrong, I've got to fix it. It's one strategy, and on some level it does work, but I'm wanting to bring NVC consciousness into what we're doing also. And as I started thinking about it, I realized that part of my struggle in doing any kind of social change work hasn't really been about the other person, because the other people are going to do what they're going to do. I'm going to bring all of the skills and knowledge that I have to change it, but a lot of it starts with myself. The ways that I view the world, the way that I've internalized what's going on in the world, the ways that I've learned how to shut down my reactions, tell myself I'm not good enough, I can't do this. There's so many different aspects of who I am that impact whatever kind of social change I want to do. So I'm hoping in these 6 weeks to kind of start by looking at ourselves, looking at who we are and how we got to be the way that we are, and then start to move towards, and how can we take that self-knowledge and apply to an understanding of how other people are moving through the world, and then bring those two together to see how we can actually create change. So today we're going to start off with a pretty deep dive into ourselves and then a little bit of exploration about how what we're talking about today relates to other groups. And we'll keep doing that every week with the hope that at the end of 6 weeks, you'll have a better sense of how you can connect with people who are different from you in a place that's fully grounded in who you are. One of the visual analogies in the title of the course was around creating bridges, right? And when I thought about creating bridges, this became really meaningful for me, because I think of a bridge as spanning, like, especially if I think of a bridge as spanning a river, it's situated in two different lands. And I want each end of the bridge to be planted very deeply, to be grounded in an understanding of what that territory is, what's important about it, and that both are important. We're not trying to totally get rid of one leg, because then the bridge collapses. We're really trying to have deep understanding of both territories and bring them together to be able to create change and to create connection. So I'm going to share my screen and talk a little bit. This picture, I mean, I'm hoping you all can see, and if you can't see, I'm also going to try to talk it, describe it verbally. This is a picture of a baby. And I'm not the world's best artist, but this baby has a head right here, and the baby has a body. This is our genetic baby. And when we talk about this model, I first like to talk about the fact that I'm talking about babies as if every baby is born with the same capacity, and they're not. I want to acknowledge that some babies have physical disabilities, some babies have mental disabilities. There are a lot of different challenges that babies can be inherently born with. And so in this model, I'm talking about an average child in a way that I also want to acknowledge doesn't always represent the reality for so many children. So this is our baby. And this baby is kind of your generic baby that exists anywhere in the world. Babies exist and they're born, and every baby who's born has the same kinds of needs. So I'd love to hear people name some of the needs that babies have. Just kind of popcorn it out. What are some of the things that babies need?
Quite a few are coming through. We've got food, love, human contact, water, comfort, touch, to be touched, connection, shelter, safety and security, connection, stimulation.
So yes, babies need all of these things. Why did my window go away? So food, love, what are some others?
Meaning, physical care, stimulation.
Stimulation, yeah.
Connection, safety, touch, comfort.
So babies need all of these things, right? And every baby everywhere in the world needs these things. Even a child who's born with various handicaps also needs all of these things, right? They might get those needs met in different ways, but all over the world, no matter where a child is born, they're going to need this and many other things that you all started to name. They're going to need play and love, comfort, touch. Some of these things are things that if a child doesn't have, they literally die. So, you know, we kind of already know if a child doesn't have food or clean air, they're going to die. But children who are not touched also have failure to thrive, and they also end up dying. So babies everywhere in the world need these different things. Babies are also born with amazing capacities to get their needs met. So when you think about NVC, NVC has this gigantic list of needs. Babies already know how to get their needs met, which is really amazing when we think of babies being these pretty weak creatures that rely on adults for pretty much everything. So I'd love to hear you say, what are some of the ways that babies get their needs met? What are some of the capacities that they have that allow them to get their needs met? Again, if you can call them out, if folks are typing them in.
Yes, they are cute.
Yes.
Crying. Lots of cryings, looking, eye contact, smiling, reaching, gurgling, cooing, babbling, all fall under sound, touching and tasting.
Yeah, babies have so many different strategies in order to get their needs met. Even the way that they're physically created, the way their faces are structured with really big eyes, stimulate adult sense of, oh my gosh, that's cute, I have to take care of it. And then we move towards that infant and we help take care of it. How many of you who are parents, when you hear a baby cry, any baby, you find yourself turning towards that infant thinking, somebody needs help, right? We are very, very conditioned to take care of our little ones. And not only parents, this is something that's kind of wired into our human behaviors. So again, we can fill out this list with many, many, many more things that are named here. But the essential idea is that when a child is born into our world, wherever they're born into the world, babies have needs and babies have capacities to get their needs met. Okay, so now this is unfortunately not the, how do you say, the entirety of what our babies experience when they come into the world, right? Babies are born in environments, and different environments have different challenges for our babies. Some of the conditions that babies grow up in can be incredibly harsh. If you're an incredibly lucky baby born in some parts of the United States, you grow up where some of these needs that we've listed, such as food, physical care, play, there's abundant opportunities in your world, in your environment, to help you get these needs met. In the United States, and in many countries, there are children born in environments where the capacity of the environment to meet these needs are very constrained. For instance, I was born in Trinidad, which is, a lot of people don't know where it is, very tiny island right near Venezuela that was a British colony. And I came to the United States when I was 7 and moved to Harlem. And when I moved to Harlem, at the time in which I moved to Harlem, it was a very, very distressed community. There had been a lot of challenges with drug wars, with impact of crime, a lot of challenges in our community. And so I went from living in a community where it was super easy to get my needs met. I had a lot of people, a lot of family around me. There was lots of space to play, lots of open air. My grandpa would climb up in the coconut tree in our backyard every morning and cut down a coconut for us to drink. You know, ample fresh food, fresh air, lots of really wonderful community around me. So a lot of these needs, stimulation, connection, care, were met abundantly by my community. When I came to the United States, most of that disappeared, right? And pretty suddenly. When I came to the United States, my parents, who were immigrants, were working incredibly hard. So my mom became a live-in housekeeper. And all of a sudden, I went from having access to a mom and having a mom who was gone 5 days a week. My dad was working several jobs trying to make sure that he could make ends meet. Our neighborhood wasn't safe, so my parents wouldn't allow us to leave our house. We could go to school and we could come back, but we weren't really allowed to go outside to play. So you're getting a sense of how the environment can constrain a lot of our capacity to be able to meet our needs as this infant grows up. I'd love to hear some examples from you all about some of the ways that you could imagine the environment impacts how babies, how children, how people are able to meet their needs. It could be about environment in which you grew up and how that environment shaped whether or not you were able to meet your needs, or the environments when you think about other children in other parts of our planet. What are some of the ways that the environment that these children find themselves in impact their capacity to meet their needs?
What came to mind was eating meals together, a place where you're consuming food together, but also that you're talking and you're sharing your day together, and how that experience and whether or not you have that experience is a really significantly different just environment.
Absolutely. When I think about that specific example, I think about my parents, again, my dad working until midnight, my mom being away, right? So we didn't eat a lot of meals together. And what needs does that leave unmet when families are not able to come together? What needs would go unmet for that child?
A big one for me is to be seen and heard.
Yeah.
Because I'm aware that it might not have always been positive. I tended to be the one at the table that spilt my milk on a regular basis. But I was seen. I was part of the crowd. I belonged.
Yeah.
Belonging. Oh my goodness, I hadn't even thought of that.
Absolutely. That really deep intrinsic sense of no matter what my day is like, there's a place where I belong. There's a community that I belong to, right?
Yeah.
Thank you. Anyone else wants to share a bit around what are some ways that you see environment impacting our youth's ability to meet their needs?
But I think about the kinds of situation that I grew up with, that those forces that impacted our families were in large measure beyond their control. And that contributed a lot. So the environment beyond just the nuclear family in quotes or the immediate environment, but how governmental policies and regulations and systemic injustice impact a person's capacity to get their needs met.
Thank you so much for naming that. That's one of the things we're going to be talking about later in today's class that I think is important to name up front. One of the ways that we start to, in some ways, judge and demonize and blame folks is when we attribute to the person or to the family situations that are really systemic. So we look at, I can imagine, for instance, in the United States, growing up and seeing all of the television commercials about happy families sit down and have dinner together, right? And all of these commercials where the mom is cooking in the kitchen and greeting the kids after school. And that was not my family. And it could be really easy to think that's the norm. That's what should be happening. And if it's not happening for me, there's a problem with my parents. There's a problem with me. Instead of thinking, what is the system that makes it that my parents have to work out of the home in two jobs in order to survive in this country in the most basic level, right? And so really looking at not just what's happening with the individual, but what are the systemic environmental conditions that are leading the individual to so drastically not meet their needs. Thank you. Ooh, I see a couple more hands, then we'll go to the next teaching piece.
I have a very unusual mother. She could not hear, not a sound. And they didn't have those boxes for the deaf people back then like they do have now, or a light that lights up and blinks when the child is crying. She put me in the bed with her, but often she was drunk. And so that was a huge thing for me, to not be heard.
Absolutely. And so for you, as a child, you're leveraging every single capacity that we say children have, right? You're crying, you're moving, you're doing all sorts of things. But if your caretaker, your mom, is both not able to hear you and then not conscious because of alcoholism, your needs are going fundamentally unmet in a very persistent way. Yeah. And so some of these, this is pointing to, again, that some of these things can be systemic. Some of them can be individual, like your mom's deafness. And some of them, like her alcoholism, I imagine was a combination of And we'll talk about this in a minute, the strategies that she used to cope with quite a few systemic challenges. Thank you.
I was thinking about my children, and one of their greatest memories is being able to play in our neighborhood, and they would go absolutely everywhere. They knew every inch of everything. And that is one of their greatest, fondest memories. And that changed with some kind of fear of neighbors and fear of this and fear of that that seemed to come over maybe through schools and other places. And, you know, you had to take care of your kids and the concern around, you know, whether DSS would come and do something if you weren't really careful with your kids and so forth. So they lost, you know, that ability to play with each other. They didn't have those opportunities or to explore and to be who they were. It seems to have been a big loss. And neighbors would be afraid to have their kids speak to people across the street. Don't speak to them. They're strangers. So there was something that was going on there in the 80s and the 90s that really made a drastic change in the way
Absolutely.
We talk about each other.
And so this, again, I love some of the examples because I can see it really helps point out both the systemic and the systemic in ways that we're not thinking about. So there was a period of time, like I said, in Trinidad for me, when your children were very small, for you, when we would let kids out and just say, go, be free range kids. There's a sense of belonging, community, safety. So many needs are met when kids know that adults around me are here to watch over me and I can just go out there and play and trust everything is going to be safe. And for some communities, they just didn't have that. It really wasn't safe for me to just go out and play in my neighborhood when I was growing up in the United States. And for some communities, there was a fear that might not have been reality-based, but it still impacted how we were able to hold our children and impacted our children's sense of safety, of being able to move freely in the world, of being able to trust people. So right now, we've talked about the fact that there are wonderful, innocent babies who are born, and these babies have needs, just like every baby in the world. Babies have capacities to meet their needs, more or less. And then we take this baby and we put them in environments, and the environments constrain how well their needs are going to be met. What's really important about this and why I wanted to bring this is that because of these constraints in our environments, the needs don't go away, right? So this child who needs to know that I belong, I have a place where I'm really seen and valued, still has that need, even if their parents are working 24 hours a day. In my neighborhood growing up, if a lot of parents were incarcerated, the child still had a need to belong. The children who can no longer feel safe going out in their neighborhoods still have a need for safety. They still have a need for community. And so what happens for all of us is that when we are in environments where our needs are not being met and held, we come up with behaviors to meet those needs. Because we're smart. This is what human beings are incredibly, amazingly talented at doing. We think, gotta get this need met. I'm going to find the most creative way to get it met. From the outside, it might not look as the most effective way or the safest way to get the need met, but no matter what, we're going to try to get those needs met. So when you think about, for instance, just think about the situation that I was describing when I came to the United States, right? I'm in the United States, and I'm going to use my siblings as an example for this because I'll share a little bit about why I was different. We're in the United States. You really value community and connection and a sense of belonging, and you're different than other folks. You are used to being out and playing and hanging out with everyone, and your neighborhood isn't safe. If you go out, you might get beat up. There are gangs everywhere. What would you do if you wanted to be able to leave your house and hang out and have a sense of belonging when your parents were not around and the neighborhood wasn't safe? What's the most logical thing that you would do? Exactly. Thank you. Join the gang. Absolutely, I would join the gang. It's like, well, if I want to be able to leave my house and be safe and have friends and community, gangs are a really great strategy for that. Again, the kind of folks who are not in that community looking at the gangs are saying, oh, they're dangerous. That's not safe. But for the child in that community, that's the safest place for them to be able to walk the streets and know that they're not going to get beat up. That's a really extreme example, right? But this is an example that goes through every aspect of our lives. When I think about young women who grew up in families where, for many different reasons, needs for love and affection aren't met, what do they do to get those needs met? What do they do? Yeah, prostitution, some guy, absolutely. We find any way that we can to know that I matter, I belong, I'm loved. Our bodies are wired for touch. And so it's like, okay, if I am not getting love, a sense of belonging and mattering anywhere else, and a guy is promising it to me or someone else, I'm going to go for it. So we find ourselves with a lot of behaviors that are tragic, that from the outside we could see how, yes, this behavior is meeting a need, but there are a lot of needs that are not being met by this behavior. And we still engage in these behaviors because those needs still need to be met. They don't go away just by saying, let's stop that behavior. And that's always one of the challenges around changing behavior or looking at other people and judging them. We're going to talk a bit more about this in a little bit. My biggest strategy for behavior change, which has been moderately effective, is I will shame myself and beat myself up. It's like, that's bad. You know that's stupid. It's not effective. It's not working. And only a stupid person would do that thing. How many people do that kind of, I'm going to beat myself up as a way to change my behavior? So many of us engage in this kind of shaming and blaming ourselves as a way to motivate behavior change. The problem with that, though, is the need that's motivating that behavior, that's maintaining it, is still there. And so I might be able to get myself to stop doing X, and I'm just going to replace it with Y. And Y might not be any better. And so I always tell folks, don't change a behavior until you know what's causing it, what's motivating it, and you have an alternative that you actually really like that's effective. Otherwise, you're just kind of leaving the gates wide open for another maladaptive behavior to come in. I want to talk a little bit about something. This is going to help frame what you're going to do in small groups. I want you to think about this model. And this model was from a really brilliant woman named Lillian Comas-Diaz. And I've learned about her work through some of my colleagues. I want you to think about this model and apply it to yourself. How many of you have a behavior that you don't like? It might be something you do, a speech pattern, way you talk to people, anything that you don't like. Most of us, right? I have many. And we have these behaviors and we always know that we should change them and we don't. And we don't actually usually take time to explore where did it come from. So this is what I want you to do in small groups. In your small groups, I want you to share a behavior that you have that you're not really excited about, right? One that you're judging. And with your small group, I want you to figure out, where did this behavior start? What were the environmental conditions that made this behavior the one that seemed the most suitable, the most powerful to address a need? What need was I trying to meet at that time? And give yourselves, give each other empathy for the needs that were going so unmet and for the behaviors that you chose. If I were to give an example of that for me, the behavior that I talk about the most, I've shared that I came to the United States and, you know, I was mostly an indoor child. My parents were out working. Unlike my siblings, I was very shy. So my siblings were just like, my parents say we can't leave the house. I'm leaving the house anyway. I'm going to join whichever semi-dangerous group is out there, but I'm going to have friends. I'm going to have community. I didn't have that because I was so incredibly shy. But I still had needs for belonging. I still had needs for community. I still had needs for nurturing and that sense of like comfort, right? And so what I did, my strategy, was books. Books became my friends. I read a lot. And I could tell you, like, I could completely visualize every single person in my book. I would have stories about them. They became my community. And what I wanted, the most comforting thing I could imagine doing, was to make a really amazing dish of something yummy and sweet, get a good book, and just sit and read and eat. And this was my strategy in an environment that said, it's not safe for you to leave the house. You don't quite fit in. You have a very funny accent. All of the things that made life difficult for me, this was the way for me to get those needs met. Reading and baking. And that's what I did for most of my childhood. So not necessarily a bad strategy, right? And this is something that's really important to recognize. Because I was a bookworm, it got me really far in school. I kind of fit the United States values, right? Here's a kid who's really smart, who's reading a lot, got a lot of praise and adulation for that. It helped me to go as far as I did. And at the same time, baking and eating a lot of sweet stuff also made me overweight, which led to a lot more distancing from other people, a lot of judgment, a lot of ways that it reinforced me not fitting in. I'm older now. I have other strategies to get those needs met. And it's still my go-to strategy. It's still the strategy when I am most stressed out, when I'm really concerned, when I'm overwhelmed, I go to like, I've got to read a book and I've got to eat something. And it's unconscious almost, right? I can beat myself a lot about why don't I just have the willpower to just change the strategy? Or I can hold a lot of compassion and tenderness for those moments where stress goes back to this default strategy of, here's the thing that reliably for 2/3 of my life helped me feel better when I was stressed. I can hold a lot of compassion for myself. And so my challenge has been, how do I find other ways to find comfort and ease in those moments when I'm most stressed without demonizing myself if I fall back to the ones that have worked quite effectively for so long? So this is what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to think about a behavior that you're judging. When did you have? And figure out, just like I did, when did it start? What was maintaining that behavior and what needs were you trying to meet? And again, offer empathy for what was going on and to support each other and to kind of digging deep to find out, was that where that behavior originated? Was that the thing, the need that you were trying to meet? Try to go as deep as you can in the time that we have. I'm going to have you work in groups of 3, and I'm going to give ample time, about 10 minutes a person, so about 30 minutes in your groups to do this exploration. So welcome back, everyone. I'd like to hear from a couple of people, just a little bit about, how did you experience the behaviors that you had previously been judging? What was your experience of those behaviors, looking at it through this lens? So anyone who'd like to share?
This is a behavior that I've been aware of for a long time, and I really got to see how it came to be out of just this incredible terror of just fear, terror, and that. So it happens when I get triggered. So I go into, you know, it could be flight or fight. Often it's fight. I got to actually experience that, those young parts in me, like physically experience them, and aware that one thing that I have been doing is learning to pause and to ground myself in that moment, and to give myself permission to pause, that I can like take it at my own pace. That's been very helpful in being able to respond differently from a more present, grounded place.
I'm really appreciating you naming this, and just the tenderness of how many of our behaviors come from times in our life that were so profoundly unmet, that terror is really the word that helps describe it, and that it continues to impact us decades later. And the importance of being able to pause, being able to say, with a lot of compassion and tenderness and care, I actually like to thank the part of me that developed a strategy that isn't really working for me now, as having just incredible strength to come up with any strategy in a moment of terror, and to be able to acknowledge that and then still give myself that pause to see if I want to stretch towards some other strategy, some other option. So thank you for naming this.
A piece that came up for me was around recognizing that there is logic in the choices that I'm making, even if they're not things that I enjoy. And so for me, the journey now is around discovering the reasons why. So it allows me to let go of this idea of it being a flaw, because it is something that, you know, my body, my mind, whatever, chose to do to survive. And it may come from the wisdom that I had as a child. And the gift that I have as an adult is that I get to engage with that wisdom and explore it a little bit more, and to not hold it as a fault, but hold it as a query.
Thank you so much. And just kind of wanting to reiterate again, you know, as an adult, I have children. And when I look at the choices that my children are making, I could say, oh, my dear, you don't want to make that choice, right? I have a different wisdom as an adult than I had as a child. It doesn't invalidate the wisdom of the child. It doesn't invalidate the strategies that the child sees as available to them. And so part of the challenge many of us have is that we start to judge our behaviors, even when we have the insight on where they came from. We start to judge it from an adult lens, from the lens of the person who's now more secure, more safe in a different context. And we don't remember that terror, the context that led us in the wisest, most logical way to choose the behaviors that we chose way back then. And so being able to hold a lot of compassion and tenderness, and also just gratitude for the parts of us that led us to say, I'm going to survive no matter what, right? I'm going to make sure that I thrive and I get my needs met no matter what. That's actually quite a beautiful, strong thing, resilient thing that we bring and that underlies some of our really challenging behaviors.
Thank you.
So how does this relate to the idea of connecting across differences, right? I want to talk a little bit about that now. I'm going to screen share the little baby model that we were looking at before. And while y'all were in your small groups, I took some time to fill in the model with some of the things that you guys had named in the chat. So the baby has a lot of needs filled out that y'all had all named for security, love, connection, food, clean air, a lot of different needs that were named, and a lot of the capacities that y'all had named. And you can go through and add a whole bunch more in each of these categories. And I also made a very extensive list of all the conditions that you all had typed into the chat. So the conditions that a child might experience that's less than optimal. And you all named things that were ranging from loudness of the environment, war, violence in the home, unpredictability and instability, lack of access to a lot of physical things like air, clean, access to nature, access to medical care, a lot of different conditions that a child might experience. What does this mean? Like, we started talking a little bit about the behaviors that the child might make in response to those conditions. And you guys looked at some of these behaviors at the individual level, right? So you're experiencing certain conditions and you have an individual response to those conditions. But when I think about connecting across differences, one of the kind of almost not spoken truths that guides our society is that different groups differentially experience these conditions. So when I grew up in Harlem, many of these conditions were my experience. When I was growing up, my parents would go once a month and they would take the train for 2 hours to New Jersey to buy good food. And then they would bring it back home. And we didn't have access to a lot of really high quality food unless they were willing and had the capacity to do that. A lot of the kids and the families in my neighborhood didn't even experience that as an option because they had been part of this system for very long. Similarly, things like in my neighborhood, everybody had access to very poor education. I lucked out because there was a special program for gifted kids that two children in my entire community got into. But it meant that every other child I went to school with had pretty substandard education access. And so in the United States and many countries, there are populations that consistently, systematically experience these conditions and populations that don't. What this means, though, is that population-wise, a population might also be responding to these conditions and developing certain strategies to cope. And then we start to apply those strategies as evidence that that's who those people are, rather than this is how any group of people would respond to these conditions if they experience them. And I'll give an example to kind of make this clearer. One of the challenges, especially in my community, and especially in my family, we're relatively quiet. So we can be very loud and boisterous, but in public, decorum was very, very valued. And it's something that, at least in my community in Trinidad, was also part of our community standards. There was a certain way you presented yourself in public. So when I came to the United States, it was shocking to me to see how loud and like boisterous and in my family, it was judged, you know, like people are calling all this attention to themselves. And there became this judgment that this was what Black Americans did, right? So even as a Black person, we ended up judging other Black people because they were not like us. They were coming from a different community and from a community that had experienced over generations a society that said, you're not valued, you're not to be seen, you're not to be heard. And the response of the community to that was, no, I'm not going to let you silence me. I'm going to show up and take up space. But coming from Trinidad, where that was not fully our experience, we had a different way of navigating certain things and a judgment about an entire community. So I'm going to give a short pause here. So any questions or comments about what I've shared so far? There was a request in the chat for someone else to share an example to help deepen their understanding. I'll share a different one because you're going to actually get to work on this in small groups in a minute. So another example of the way that we start to judge communities is, again, coming from where I grew up in Harlem, there were a lot of people who stole, right? A lot of families who didn't have money, who at best were receiving social services money, and at worst were getting nothing at all. So there were kids who were hungry and kids who just didn't have anything that they needed. And if they wanted to get those things, the behavior for many of the kids was, you stole it. That's the only way that you're going to get enough food to eat, decent clothes to wear, right? And when people look at our community, they would judge our community and say, wow, Black people are thieves or Black people have no morals. And there was a sense of labeling and judging an entire community without looking at what is motivating this behavior. This behavior is not an intrinsic thing to Black people in Harlem. It's something that's a direct and in some ways a very intelligent response to a systemic condition. And so this difference between looking at the behavior and attributing it as an inherent attribute of a people versus saying that behavior is a strategy to meet a need, what need is trying to be met by many people in this community, with a recognition that the reason Black people were disproportionately in my community doing this behavior, stealing, was because they were also disproportionately impacted by an environment where they didn't have access to resources. And so it's very easy if I don't live in that environment to just look at that behavior and say, it's because those people are bad, because I don't even get, is it possible for someone not to have food, not to have their basic needs met? If it's not my experience, why would I even consider that? I'm wondering if that helped. Okay, I see a thank you. Great. So when we think about connecting across differences, this is one of our challenges. It's incredibly easy to look at someone else, and especially to look at a group of people, and think that the way that they're behaving and the way they're showing up is because that's who they are, and not to do the exact same inquiry that you just did to say, what are the systemic issues that are maintaining this behavior in this community? And I can't actually imagine being able to bridge a difference and really connect with an open heart to another person if I'm judging who they are and their entire community from a lens without any consideration of what's motivating it. I see the question.
One of the things that's triggering me in some of this is that, and this has to do with the profound level in which I'm understanding how I've been lied to by my society. And so I even challenge the idea that in your neighborhood people were disproportionately stealing. But what was happening is that your neighborhood was being blamed for a behavior that was a lot more extensive than your neighborhood. I mean, I grew up in a completely white neighborhood, mm-hmm. and people were stealing crap all the time, but it was not considered about the group is considered about those bad boys. I just wanted to name that.
I appreciate you naming that, and that's a whole other layer of analysis that we might get to as the weeks go on. But what I do want to say is part of what's important to me about this analysis is to recognize that there actually are different impacts. For instance, pretty early, like by about 12 years old, I started going to schools and programs in predominantly white neighborhoods. And when I went into those white stores, for instance, like even now here in the Bay Area where I live, if I go into the stores right around my neighborhood, which is a relatively good neighborhood, there's security guards standing at the banks. People are stealing things at the stores quite often. If I go into some areas downtown, there are no security guards. There are no, you know, I'm imagining some things are being stolen, but I am guessing that things are being stolen in certain stores at a disproportionately higher rate than they would be in stores in wealthy neighborhoods. It's not because things are not getting stolen, but it's that in our neighborhoods, more people have less money and they're going to steal because it's a rational response to be able to get your needs met. So there's a way that I want to both acknowledge that some of these statistics are inflated and hide the fact that some of these problems are universal and not specific to a group. But I also think it's important to acknowledge that different groups are impacted by the systems that we live in, and therefore show up with these different responses, and that does happen. That's a whole other debate to go into that I won't go into right now. So what I want y'all to do now, though, is to think about this. Think about a group where you're holding a judgment, something about the way they show up. You know, they're too loud, they're too this, they're too that. Some example of a group that you have a judgment about. It could even be a judgment about your own group, right? Almost all of us have internalized a lot of judgments about the groups that we belong to. If you're a woman, right, you might have a lot of judgments about other women who are too quiet, who don't, are not assertive enough. You know, so we have judgments about our in-groups and we have judgments about other groups. But what I want you to do is to think about a group-level judgment that you experience and apply the same analysis. First, what's the specific behavior that you're judging? And what conditions do you think might be differentially impacting that group that might be giving rise to that behavior more often in that group. And then what needs does that behavior meet? When women don't speak up in meetings, what needs would that meet? For a lot of women, it's like, I'm so tired of raising my voice and then I never get called on, or if I get called on, I speak and there's silence and then someone else says the same thing and then it's acknowledged because they're male. So I stop talking. It's a way to like protect myself, a way to manage kind of like disappointment and to trust that my energy is being put in a place where it has values. So it's meeting some behaviors if I choose not to speak in certain mixed groups. Meets needs for safety and trust. And see if you all can connect with the group needs that are met by the behavior, but also the needs that are not met. Because what we want to be able to do is to hold compassion and mourning when we see these behaviors occurring, rather than just judging and blaming. And I'm going to invite you to do that again in your small groups. I see the question.
I have a friend who's become very conservative, and I'm not knowing how to get what that need is.
I would invite you to bring that to your group, because I imagine that some folks might have some ideas. I'd like you to bring this example to your small group and ask them what needs are being met by, you know, someone who had almost the same life experiences as I did,
yeah,
moving to conservatism.
Yeah.
And I imagine that you'll get some support in your group. So 20 minutes in your small group to explore this. I think in closing, I'd just love to hear from a few people, how is what we've done so far, like how does it connect to what you're hoping to get out of the class? So who would like to share? How is what we've covered today connecting to what we're going to get out of the class?
I think what was so nourishing, which just happened in our group, is we talked about climate change deniers and what could be motivating them. And we started with a list of needs that made a lot of sense, but then we realized that they were filtered through our lens of thinking,
yes,
what the heck? How can you not see it? And then we turned it and we looked at how somebody, what needs might be present for somebody who doesn't believe in climate change that maintained their dignity. And it was like, oh, it was such a relief to be able to see the dignity of a group that has been vexing for me. So, wow, 20 minutes, total transformation. Thank you. I'm so happy to be in this class.
Yay. And I'm so, so loving what you said. I want to emphasize it, that it's not so much that we want to think about their needs and what might be motivating their behavior from this very paternalistic kind of place, right? Like, okay, you're just kind of screwed up, so let me think what could possibly let you have this screwed up point of view, right? Because then we still have that distance between them and us. We still see them as the other. But when we think about, and I love the way you put it, that how can I name needs that allow them to still have dignity? That's when I know that I'm really getting to that level of needs. Thank you.
I'm just celebrating that I was even able to articulate to other humans a judgment that I have about a group for the first time, and also getting some new perspectives on what they could be needing and why they could be using that strategy was really, really helpful.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. I know we're nearing the end of our time for today, so I want to give you guys two homework assignments. One homework assignment is I want you to continue to do this exploration, and to do it both for the individual level and then also when you think about other groups, people that you see as different from you, to like notice your behaviors throughout this next week. When do you start to beat yourself up? When do you start to judge yourself? And then to kind of pause and think, where did this come from? What's maintaining it? What's motivating it? And you might be completely different than me, but I always have many times during the course of a week when I'm judging myself. So just pick any one of them and apply this model to. And then the same thing might just be that you're listening to the news and you hear a story like my current trigger right now, or the folks who are saying, yes, gun violence, let's meet it with more guns. Like, just think of a group and think, what could be maintaining the strategy for them? Why are they going there? Okay. And then the second homework assignment is, if you're willing, share about this class with your friends. I just want to get this work out there. I want more and more and more people thinking about these questions and thinking about the world in this way. So let folks know what you got out of this week. Thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next week.